My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagratz, and we are back with the Western Bubble Podcast, and we are back with Donald Trump. Balder, why are we talking about Donald Trump for the third episode in a row?
I really wish we wouldn't have to, Dario. We don't want this to turn into a Donald Trump show where just we have a one-issue podcast. But we can't avoid him. Every time we talk about the United States in 2025, we make certain statements. We say that this is an important moment in history. And then after recording, things accelerate or escalate even further. And that's exactly what's happened this week. So, you know, it would be impossible to ignore the enormously historical dynamics that are taking place in front of our eyes right now.
It really would. And I mean, I've said this in a lot of past episodes, right? Particularly in the last 4 or 5 months. But the speed at which things are happening is astonishing to me. I mean, just before, right when we collected topics for this episode, you said, oh, we also have to talk about J.D. Vance at the New York Security Conference. And I stopped for a second thinking, that was at least 2 weeks ago. We surely must have talked about this. And then you told me, no, not since the last time we recorded, because it happened on Monday. And that's exactly 4 or 5 days ago.
Yeah, it just happened so quickly that it's very difficult to keep up, but also the sense of time disappears, right? I mean, it's only been a month that Donald Trump is in the White House again. I mean, and so much has happened since then. The world is accelerating, and that in itself, forget about questions about whether you like Donald Trump or you like the way that politics is evolving at the moment. The speed at which things are happening is dangerous, right? Even if you feel that it goes in the right direction, because this is a process that changes both the internal makeup of the United States and the international relations community in ways that nobody seems to control anymore. Not even Trump, not even Musk. Things are going so fast, it's almost like AI, right? AI is developing so quickly that nobody is capable of actually seeing where it's going and what the outcome will be. And I wish that we could find a way to slow things down a little bit, just to take a breath and to say, hang on, is this really the path that we want to take?
I mean, this is by design. All of this, right? It's, actually a soundbite of the Breitbart guy. His name slips my mind right now. What's his name?
Steve Bannon, the guy that has now made a comeback after disappearing for a couple of years.
Yeah, and he's the one who said, right, you just have to flood them with information, particularly the media. Because if you're doing 8 big things, they will focus on, right, the 1 or 2 really big ones. And all these 6 others, the media doesn't have the capacity to focus on. And I remember that 8 years ago, I thought that was a bunch of quatsch, right? Yeah. A bunch of nonsense. But I must say, I can focus on everything that's happening. I think I pick up 3 or 4 topics that that Trump is doing every week, and then I miss another 4 or 5.
No, but it was only like 2 weeks ago, I think, that we said this in the episode as well, that by every time taking debate and by with the liberal media for years, just jumping on every little detail about Trump, many details of which were completely irrelevant to the bigger picture. You know, we knew the guy who he was, and yet the media kept on going on and on and on about all the aspects of corruption, etc., etc. That actually helped him. It helped the MAGA movement. It helps a world in which when it gets really, really important, and in 2025 it's been really, really important, people are just switched off. They don't care anymore because they've been bombarded with this for too long. And they're the liberal media and just liberal commentators and analysts and intellectuals need to critically look at themselves. And why did they write all those hundreds of articles about relative details when the bigger picture now requires us to really, really pay attention?
It really, really pay attention. And that is so difficult because, again, it was basically a week ago that J.D. Vance went to the Munich Security Conference. And we've talked about the Munich Security Conference a lot and this podcast already, right? It's this privately organized conference once a year around February in Munich, Germany, where they bring together world leaders. And it used to have right, this kind of theme that we bring together everyone, right? And there will be a few talks held on a big stage, but the real deal happens behind the scenes. And it was actually a lovely opportunity for countries that officially might not talk to each other right now, that have bad relations, to come together. Then unfortunately, with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, right? I feel like I sometimes have to repeat this, but we are obviously not supporting or excusing any of Putin's behavior there. But unfortunately, from a Western bubble perspective, then when the invasion happened, the Munich Security Conference said, we're no longer inviting Russia. And then they quickly followed with Iran during the crackdown on the women's protests in Iran, also from 2 years ago. And since then, the conference has turned a little bit into like a mostly Western people talking to each other. And it doesn't really seem like any international actors need to be involved anymore, because the conference is very much about the West and the West in itself. And this year it was very much about J.D. Vance. I called it giving the finger to Europe.
Yeah, and in some ways, it's just clarifying something that's been happening for a long time, right? Vance giving the finger to Europe, or basically saying to Europe, not just you people are need to get your act together in ways that I still don't understand how he comes up with it, but also don't trust us to have your back, is such a enormously clear statement about where the United States is with respect to the Transatlantic Alliance. It doesn't exist anymore, which in some ways is very refreshing, because we already knew that the Transatlantic Alliance was dying. In 2017, Macron said that NATO was brain dead. It's good to be clear about this in a way, but it is also kind of astonishing that we got there in the space of 25 years, when in the 1990s, it seemed that everyone was going to be part of the Transatlantic Alliance and the world was going to be liberal and democratic, right? So essentially, I don't really mind Vance being this unpleasant. It was a really unpleasant speech with really unpleasant content. Also just, you know, idiotic content. It just didn't make any real analytical sense. But in some ways, it's good for Europe and the rest of the world to realize that the past is the past. The past is history. We are now looking towards a future where Europe cannot rely on the United States as this eternally protective partner. And that means that Europe now, you know, needs to get its act together and start thinking about what it means for itself, its future, its relations with China, its relations with India, with the rest of the world, essentially.
So that was one of the big things, right? Or these big elements of J.D. Vance's speech, right? Kind of making it clear that, hey, this transatlantic relationship as you've known and cherished it for the last 60, 70 years, that's done, right? It's done so. But one thing that really surprised me, and it's, I think in these days, it's difficult to surprise me when it comes to anything coming from the United States, right? Because what don't you expect that's happening right now? But one thing that really surprised me was Vance actively getting involved in national politics here in Germany, right? Because so actually in 2 days, the election is taking place. So that was on the weekend, right? The speech was on the weekend before the elections take place. And he openly called for voting for the far right party, right? And coming to a country, right, that invites you and be like, hey, come speak at our conference, invite you, the US vice president. We love for you to be here. And doing that, that's even more of that statement of, right, hey, kind of driving that point home, right? Now it's really over. Yeah, I don't want to have anything to do with you guys. I just want to talk to the radical right.
Yeah, so essentially the message is, we don't have an automatic alliance with Europe. We will have an alliance if Europe chooses the people that we like, that we can work with, right? Which is a huge departure from the idea that in the past, it didn't matter whether you had a left-wing government or a right-wing government, the United States would have your back, and they might have certain small preferences, but in the end, the alliance between Europe and North America, especially Europe and the United States, was there, was permanent, and was not dependent on the politics internally in either one of the two sides. And that is now completely gone. So now it's basically very much in line with Trump's overall policy. It's a very transactional relationship. You vote for the people that we can connect to, the extreme right, then we can do business. And if you don't, we will not perceive you as an ally that we can work with, which has all kinds of implications for this enormously complex global network of institutions, including NATO, but also the UN and the IMF and the World Bank, that all rely on this transatlantic kind of foundation. It means that we need to reimagine the entire way that international relations is being organized.
I mean, one of the main themes following the conference here in Germany was that everyone was so shocked by this, right? Everyone was really surprised. Do you know why? I mean, why were people surprised about this? I mean, because again, as I said, there's not really that many surprising things. I was just surprised about the severity of which he kind of went on stage with.
Well, it is surprising in the sense that it goes against arguably 200 years, at least 80 years of historical development. It's not surprising from a J.D. Vance perspective, or it's not surprising from a Trump perspective. It is consistent with who they are personally. But this is not just J.D. Vance. This is the Vice President of the United States. And I don't know if surprise is the right word or more shock. Like, okay, now it's real. Something we kind of already knew existed now is right in our face. The Vice President of the United States is basically telling us that we can no longer rely on them. And that is a psychologically difficult thing to process. And it's one of the things where I think Europe has to be careful now, that Europe doesn't try to tell itself, oh, it is just Trump or it's just Vance. It is just a momentary blip in our relationship. But the politicians that run Europe right now, at least establishment politicians, still come from this automatic assumption that the transatlantic alliance is a permanent thing. And I kind of hope that Vance's speech will wake them up from that dream. And will get them out of that historical kind of dogma, that historical kind of truth that no longer exists, and that they will start rethinking their relationship with the United States. Not one that is adversarial, but one that is actually transactional, because that's what Trump is going to do. And if Europe doesn't do the same back, then we've got a problem.
Yeah, that's interesting, right? Because that seems to be the European reaction right now, to think, okay, if we kind of lay low and we give him a few things, maybe he'll let go at some point. But yeah, you're right. He's basically a bully, like on the school ground, right? If you don't stand up to them, he's going to continue bullying you.
Indeed. And it's not just that he is a single bully, because, let's face it, he is not a very healthy person. He could get a heart attack tomorrow. By the way, I hope not. I really, really hope that he will finish the presidency, because imagine the conspiracy theories if he dies in office. I mean, that would have all kinds of horrible consequences. It's not just anymore about Donald Trump. It is about a whole system within the United States that is now part of this movement. And it could be that a Democrat gets elected after Trump leaves office. That's possible. But even the Democrats will have moved further away from the transatlantic alliance. So this is no longer just about one man. It's about a real change in the United States. And Europe simply doesn't seem to recognize that yet.
Just a few days later, Trump and basically Trump went on a phone call with Vladimir Putin, right? His good old pal from Russia. They were getting along well the first part of his first term. The second part, I remember, it deteriorated a little bit, just because I think both of them, there were big announcements and they were pretending to be buddies, but not a lot came out of it. But they went on a phone call again, and they seemed to have a lot of fun because they were on the phone for 90 minutes.
Yeah, they're back to doing business together again in a way that is rather ahistorical, right? It's not just that they get along and they communicate well, because you're right, that happened previously as well, but it was actually about a very real practical thing, namely a war that Russia started in Ukraine. And during that conversation, it is clear, we don't know the details exactly, but it is clear that the two of them essentially tried to broker a deal without Ukrainians, without Europeans present, showing not just that the two of them get along, but that they're happy to do it without any of their traditional allies, that they're, at least the United States, is happy to ignore its allies, is happy to ignore a reality where there's a war between two parties, and where Trump believes that he can get something out of Russia by bullying Ukraine, and that the Ukrainians and Europeans, from Trump's perspective, are almost like collateral damage, right? Are not relevant in the bigger picture. They're the kind of the losers that don't need to be that don't need to be included. Trump likes talking to the alpha male, to the alpha in the room, and in this case, he perceives that to be Putin.
Well, but if I remember correctly, at least according to Trump, it was Ukraine who started the war, right? That's, I mean, basically said, right? I mean, he said then afterwards on Truth Social, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal.
This is one of those issues that has been discussed for the past 20 years or so. This whole conversation about truth and facts and what is real and what isn't. It's an extreme example of how we now live in a world where we can no longer have a foundation for our conversation to start with, right? People have such different interpretations of reality. I mean, and wrong. I mean, obviously, just to be clear, obviously, Russia invaded Ukraine, not the other way around, but that should be beyond question. The fact that the United States president puts a statement out there shows that we now live in a world where everything is basically opinion. Hey, in my opinion, it's Ukraine who started it. I don't need to give you any facts. I don't have to have any knowledge, but it is just my opinion and I'm entitled to my opinion, which is one of the main diseases of our world today, that we no longer have that foundation of reality. And based on that, we can have different interpretations. That's gone. Everything nowadays is interpretation, is up for debate. And as a result, it's about vibes rather than proper analysis and proper conclusions.
And Putin and Trump were really vibing with each other. I mean, because you said that earlier, and I think we need to focus on this again. Trump and Putin sat down together on a phone call. They also want to meet in Saudi Arabia at an undefined moment in the future. And they sat down there talking about the war between Russia and Ukraine, without Ukraine, right? I can understand to a certain extent without Europe, based on the speech with Vance.
Yeah, exactly. That's that historical change, because historically it's not understandable, but because of where they are right now, you could say it's basically saying to Europe, you're no longer relevant. Yeah,
absolutely, right? You're no longer relevant. We no longer care about you. But sitting there without Ukraine is a real bully move, right? And it's exactly what you said. Is Trump doesn't like losers, right? Whether it's Ukraine or, we will be talking about that in a few minutes, the Palestinians.
Yeah, so who he perceives to be losers, right? There's an important difference there. But yeah, so he essentially has always been consistently attracted to the strong alpha male, those with power, those who can control their own societies in authoritarian ways. This is why he got quite close to Kim Jong-un from North Korea. This is why he got a good relationship with Erdogan from Turkey going. He kind of admires them. He wishes that he could be an authoritarian leader like them. And when they tell him, look, those Ukrainians, they're just washed up. And when Putin says to Trump, you don't take them seriously, they're nobodies, and we have been limiting our military force because we don't want to create too much destruction, but in reality, we could easily blow the Ukrainians away if we wanted to, then Trump accepts that. It makes sense intuitively to Trump that someone like Putin is the reasonable, strong guy here. And that leads to these outrageous situations, right? So morally, it is, I would argue, reprehensible. Now, I think we try to not talk about morality too much in this podcast because morality is always up for a debate. What is your starting point? What's your end point? But even just purely analytically, to say, I am going to make a deal with Russia without Ukraine at the table, has enormously destructive consequences for the United States in the long run, because it means that the United States no longer pretends to be the reasonable country in the world. They no longer pretend to somehow be the peace broker or the mediator. They are now just a power player like everyone else.
Which they used to be in the past, right? This power player as a peace broker, right? Kind of saying that, hey, there's a conflict between two parties. Right. I'm not going to get involved on who's right or wrong, but me as the power force, I will make sure to step in and kind of keep the peace, right? What the United Nations was once intended to be, the United States, with its, right, with what we've criticized in the past, with its own kind of self-righteousness, became kind of saying that, hey, we will be the ones assuring the peace between two factions or two countries. And that is completely gone, right? Now it's more about, well, we are going to broker peace so that Ukraine, because we've sent you so much money, we want your minerals, right? I mean, it's crazy how fast this happened, right? I mean, going from the United States that it was at least a semi-constructive actor, and there was a lot to criticize about them, to this.
Yeah, and the reason why Americans should panic about this more than the rest of the world is that the United States has hugely benefited from that position in the past, right? Basically being able to say to the world, we are the ones who cannot ever be avoided. You want to operate in this world, you're going to have to deal with us because we are the policemen of the world. We're the indispensable nation. We are the nation that is special, is different from everyone else. And if you accept that, if you accept our leadership and you accept our power, we're going to be generous towards you. We're going to work with you and you're going to benefit. And if you oppose us, we will fight you and we will win. That was essentially the basis of US foreign policy in modern times. And now, with this change in foreign policy, the United States is giving up that indispensable position. They're giving up their exceptional position, which means that in the next 10, 20, 30 years, the United States will have much less influence, much less power as a result, because they're just going to be like any other country, like China, like Russia, like India, like the European Union. They're just going to have to fight for their turf rather than have this exceptional position that has given them so many benefits over the past 80 years or so.
Do you see anyone stepping up, filling that position? Because I saw some commentary the other day that focused on US aid, right? We've talked about this in one of the previous episodes, right? Basically, Musk and Trump cutting, or well, for now, freezing the US aid budget for 90 days, but cutting it as well. And I saw commentary saying that the Europeans, at a fraction of the price, right, could now step in, finance all these programs, and have the biggest soft power gain in almost history.
Now, that is completely obvious. And not just Europeans, right? China is doing the same. So people are jumping into that vacuum that the United States is now leaving behind. Again, if you're an American citizen, you look around the world and you see your potential rivals benefiting from your current foreign policy, having a space that otherwise they would never have had, but neither the European Union, nor China, nor India, nor Russia are in any way powerful enough to become that new indispensable nation. It will just be a collection of powerful states with a number of states very near that, like Brazil, Turkey, etc., etc., that are all trying to carve out a little bit of the space around them. But that exceptional position of the United States is now basically completely being given up by the Trump administration. The Trump administration is now forfeiting arguably 200 years of American power politics that has made the United States into this exceptionally influential country for such a long time. I don't understand why commentators in liberal media, for example, focus so much on moral aspects rather than telling Americans, you guys are at the moment behaving completely idiotically. You had this enormous position that every other country would love to have, and you're just giving it up like that. Under the guise of, oh, make America great again, you're actually making America very, very weak on the international stage. And that's exactly why I am a little bit ambiguous about the long-term consequences at a foreign policy level. If you're Ukrainian, it's terrible news. If you're Palestinian, it's terrible news. But for countries in the European Union or for China, India, it is not necessarily bad news, but it's terrible news for US citizens.
One last point before we move on to the topic of Gaza. Trump also called Zelensky a dictator without elections. He's right. Right, because Zelensky Ukraine hasn't had elections in a few years, and they keep on being postponed because of a state of war. So, I mean, at least on that part, he must have been right, right? He said in an ironic tone.
But to some extent he is right. It's just completely an irrelevant question, right? Or it's an irrelevant issue. During a war like this, and this is an absolutely existential war for Ukraine, of course democracy dies. It always has. You know, you're not going to have the ability, even if Zelensky wanted to, and I think it's clear he doesn't, but even if he wanted to have elections, it's impossible to properly do that at a time that half of your country is under threat from Russian occupation. Of course you're not going to have elections, and of course there's going to be an authoritarian aspect to leadership. That is not me justifying that, but that is how war behaves. That is what war does to liberal democracy. It happens in every other historical case as well. You can't even a country like Britain during the Second World War was not really a democracy. There was no space for democratic processes in the same way that there would be before and after the war. The point is not whether Zelensky is dictatorial or not. It's not about whether he wants to exclude local opposition. I think it's clear that he wants to do that. It is not relevant to the analysis of what should be the outcome of peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. The only reason why Trump mentions this and uses this word dictator is basically to take pressure away from Putin. And it is basically to put pressure on Ukrainians and to say, look, you're going to have to give in. We no longer have good vibes between each other. I no longer feel that I've got some kind of special connection with you. I actually feel much closer to Putin, and both of you are dictators, so it doesn't matter. So it's basically about vibes. It's got nothing to do with reasonable analysis.
One last point, and then we really move on to Gaza, I promise. Did you see the moment that Zelensky stepped up on stage at the Munich Security Conference last week? I think it was 1 year ago, he was greeted by applause for minutes. And this time, and speaking about bursting the Western bubble a little bit, he was still greeted with applause, but not for minutes. Right? It was a lot shorter.
Yeah, as you know, I typically don't watch videos in order to... I read about it. I don't like watching videos for lots of reasons. Those kinds of videos. I love cute cat videos or something like that. But it is completely obvious that the shine is gone from Ukraine. And this is a problem for Ukraine. And we've talked about this endlessly in other episodes. But 2 years ago, everyone wanted to be part of the whole fight against Russia because it seemed that Ukraine were the winners. Now nobody believes that Ukraine are the winners. The world is changing. People are tired of the whole conflict. I mean, not as tired as Ukrainians, but you know, people who are not affected by the war in Ukraine are something like, I want to move on. Oh, they've got Zelensky again. Zelensky also kind of burned some bridges with his attitude early on. He overstepped his power and his influence very clearly with some terrible speeches in domestic parliaments, in national parliaments around the world. He made some really big mistakes, and people got basically fed up with him, and he tried to morally blackmail many Europeans to give further weapons and financial aid. So there are certainly a lot of mistakes that Ukraine and Kiev made, overstepping their bounds and not sufficiently realizing that there were limits to the way the world looks at Ukraine. Having said that, Europeans were overly enthusiastic then and are now all of a sudden weirdly not insufficiently willing to actually do something about it, right? To take responsibility. Europeans now would like to pretend as if they've got nothing to do with this whole conflict and it's kind of not their problem and all that. And that is painful because of course Europe has something to do with it. If not for anything else, then the fact that Europeans encouraged Ukraine to continue the war when they shouldn't have.
Moving from one painful topic to another painful topic, Trump also made a statement on Gaza, right? That actually already happened 2 weeks ago, but because the world is so busy and we recorded our 100th episode on a slightly different topic. But Trump, while Netanyahu was in visiting him in DC, right, in the White House, he had an idea. I don't know if idea is the right term here. It might be disrespectful to the term idea, but he had a thought that the United States could take over Gaza and remove the population of Gaza to neighboring countries, right? For reference, it's about 2.2 million people living there. and then they could rebuild it and turn it into amazing real estate area with basically the Riviera of the Middle East, right? Because they have a beautiful coastline and it would be all lovely and amazing. It isn't, I mean, I was never that good at international law classes during my degree, but isn't that what some would consider ethnic cleansing?
It would be, absolutely. So it's very clear that both Israel and Trump's position right now come very, very close to ethnic cleansing, especially because some conservative commentators suggested that it was just a matter of temporary moving out in order to rebuild. But then it was clarified immediately that that's not what the White House is talking about. They don't want an automatic right of return, even for those who are now living in Gaza. So, I think ethnic cleansing is a valid, analytically appropriate term there. What is interesting from a broader perspective is how Trump views these things. And this makes me go back to Ukraine again a little bit. Trump sees himself as a winner. And he wants to be associated with winners. He doesn't feel a need to protect losers. He's essentially a bully, and bullies don't care about people who are in vulnerable positions. They look up to those who they perceive to be strong. And if there's one people in the world throughout the past 80 years that has been bullied, it's the Palestinians, right? And from Trump's perspective, that makes them losers. And I in a podcast, you can't see it, but I would do air quotes here, right? Because of course they are not losers. They are losers of history because history has been incredibly cruel to the Palestinians. But there's nothing loserish about Palestinians themselves, except that from Trump's perspective, they are bad for his image. He doesn't have time for them. He has time for MBS, who is this incredibly rich crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. He has time for Vladimir Putin, who is this incredibly powerful authoritarian figure in one of the most powerful nations on earth. He doesn't have time for some people living in Gaza who have had their houses bombed, who have lost their loved ones, because for Trump, they are irrelevant. And that goes back to the Ukraine thing as well. He has no sympathy for Ukraine now because Ukraine has struggled over the past 2 years to actually maintain its borders. If Ukraine had had military success, Trump's approach to that would have been very different.
You mentioned MBS already. And he's, as you said, one of those strong men that Trump really likes. He's in a bit of an interesting situation right now, right? Because as Saudi Arabia is kind of seen as the protectors of the Palestinians somehow, right? In a vague way. And Saudi Arabia is kind of the crown jewel when it comes to normalizing relations with Israel. One of those things that's really driving Trump, because he received so much praise for the Abraham Peace Accords, right, in 2020, when four Arab countries normalized relations with Israel. And Trump really wants to push for Saudi Arabia and all other countries to normalize relations with Israel, right? It's a bit complex, right? Because of his personal connections to Israel, because of his close, good connections with Netanyahu. But this is, I'm actually interested in how this is going to play out, because you have MBS, right? Who is a strong man. You have Trump, who is a strong man. And they somehow need to make a deal, big quotation marks, right, on Gaza. And it's just today that MBS has invited the Gulf countries and Egypt and Jordan to kind of meet and counter his plan, because I assume this is unacceptable to them, right? I do not see a scenario in which any of the Arab countries, including the Palestinians, would accept this Trump plan.
No, of course not. Now, I would also say that you already signaled the vagueness of Saudi protection of Palestinians. This has always been a little bit of smoke and mirrors for Saudi Arabia, right? Saudi Arabia has always pretended to be the guardians of Sunni Islam and the guardians of Palestinians. But in reality, they've never really put the money where their mouth was. They spend a bit of money on Palestinians every year, but it's relatively small amounts. I think 200 million a year, something like that, relatively to the bigger picture from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has always pretended to be there, but they've never actually really endangered their own existence in any way. Unlike, for example, Egypt before the Camp David Accords of 1978, right? Egypt was involved in three wars with Israel as leader of the Arab world, trying to not necessarily just protect Palestinians, but also get rid of Israel, or at least Israeli power. Egypt failed in that. In 1978, they signed a peace agreement, but they at least saw it as a truly existential mission, in a way that maybe Iran now still views its own relation with Israel. Saudi Arabia has never had that approach. Saudi Arabia has always been sort of in the back, you know, shouting here and there to Israel and telling Israel off for sometimes doing certain things, refusing to meet Israeli diplomats in the past, but never actually putting themselves on the line for the Palestinians. So the idea that now, with a new, if you like, world order shaping up, Saudi Arabia and the United States are talking about the Palestinians in a way that, you know, might actually in any scenario be beneficial for the Palestinians is a fantasy. Saudi Arabia is not going to give up their own strategic interests in order to defend, protect, or save the Palestinian people. The only problem that Saudi Arabia has is that if they are seen as too blatantly dropping the Palestinians, then their whole mirage, their whole image of protectors then collapses, and that might have some unfortunate consequences. So that's the only sort of marketing problem that Saudi Arabia has. But I would be amazed if behind the scenes the Saudis really care about Palestinians.
One of the bigger themes that we've talked about in the past 100 episodes, just making sure to highlight that again, has been that constant shift, right? And kind of that faster shift of like the center towards the right. And that leads to situations where for us now, it's a completely normal conversation to kind of talk with these right-leaning narratives. For me, it's incredible, right, to kind of transfer this to the conversation we're having right now. For me, it's incredible that the two of us now have been talking for 10 minutes about this deal, quote unquote deal, that Trump has proposed, and kind of the likelihood of this deal and so on and so forth, and that we are very, very far removed from anything that would actually work for either side, for Israel or the Palestinians, right? Our conversation is only about this, and not anymore about the things that actually matter and that would actually have an impact on the world, right? It's just a thought I just had over the last few minutes, thinking, wow, these are interesting topics, and right, we're putting up scenarios and we're trying to put forward our analysis, but this doesn't have any value for the people on the ground.
Well, but I think that last bit is where the key is. It doesn't have any value for the people on the ground. The question is whether the Saudis, and then when I say Saudis, I'm not talking about the nationality, I'm talking about leadership, the House of Saud, and Trump and Israel, if they care about the people on the ground, right? And what it is that they actually want to achieve. Now, of course, if the Saudis were to actually put the Palestinian plight, the future of the Palestinian people on the table as an important factor, then that would be a different story. But we are pretty certain that they don't. And so their objectives have nothing to do with the Palestinians, and the Palestinians are just a victim of history in that sense. They are completely ignored in the agenda. So it's going to have benefits for the Saudi position if they can make a deal with Israel and they can make a deal with the Trump administration. That is going to be beneficial to Saudis to a certain extent. To Trump, it might be beneficial from his very myopic perspective of what the United States should be doing. As I just argued, in the long term, it's bad for the US because it reduces their leadership around the world. But in the short term, it might give him some benefits, even personal benefits when it comes to deals and all that. And for Israel, for the Netanyahu government, another alpha male that Trump seems to like and that he can work with, of course, there is the political factor of not wanting to go back to normalcy, because that would mean a return to him facing corruption charges. People are actually still asking questions about, hey, weren't you supposed to defend ourselves against terrorist attacks? How come that this horrific attack on the 7th of October 2023 actually could take place. So Netanyahu needs to create a world in which either he can walk away as a heroic victor or where the conflict somehow continues. That has nothing to do not with the security of the Israeli people, let alone the Palestinians. It's got to do with political interests for Trump, for Netanyahu, and for MBS. And yeah, that's the welcome to the new reality, that these leaders do not represent the well-being of their own populations or human civilization in any way. They represent their own interests.
I feel really bad for, I think, quite a significant part of our audience who all either study or have studied international relations. Because the way that I was taught conflict management, right, or conflict resolution, has nothing to do with the reality that we're looking at right now. So when you just said welcome to the reality, I felt a little bit called out, because how am I supposed to solve any conflicts in the future with my international security degree?
No, and this is actually, I don't want to get into too much academia here, but this is one of the problems that has existed for a long time. And in my lectures, I've spoken a lot about this. International relations for too long has pretended that IR is just about these Westphalian countries clashing into each other, and the leaders of those Westphalian countries represent their citizens. And we now, in the 21st century, live in a world where that has been increasingly different, where increasingly leaders are no longer particularly interested in representing people, but to represent economic and political interests. And that has accelerated over the past month, with this blatantly and obviously right in your face being true with the White House and the US administration and the billionaire supporting that kind of agenda, right? So international relations in the traditional sense is no longer a valid discipline in analyzing these world dynamics. We need to talk much more about the psychology of leaders, the different pressure points of leaders, rather than believing that the President of the United States protects US citizens. Yes, newsflash, he doesn't. He's not interested in US citizens. Even the Prime Minister of Israel doesn't represent Israeli security. He represents political and personal interests that might actually very aggressively go against security interests of your average Israeli citizen. And nobody has ever cared about the Palestinians to begin with. So there we are.
Well, for anyone interested in this type of analysis, please make sure to visit erayagroup.org, because that's something, right? That's something that that you started, and I'm still continuing, and where that type of analysis we at least try to provide. And I think that this is a great moment to end today's conversation on 1 month of Donald Trump and 1 week of absolute craziness, so that we kind of had to cover three topics that we would usually dedicate an entire episode to. We had to cover them all in 45 minutes. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com. We will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I've chosen a quote from Aldous Huxley from Brave New World, which is a novel that, of course, is famous, maybe not to the levels of 1984 by George Orwell, but certainly has had a major impact on our Western culture. And I chose this quote specifically because one of the tragic things that we are seeing right now in the Western world is that the masses, understandably annoyed or angry with an establishment that has failed to protect their interests, are lashing out by hurting their own interests even more through Brexit, through voting for Donald Trump, where you've got these enormously large groups of people who are just confused about their role and their society and actually endanger their own interest and the long-term interest of their own societies. And the quote goes, "A really efficient totalitarian state would be one in which the all-powerful executive of political bosses and their army of managers control a population of slaves who do not have to be coerced because they love their servitude."